Hello, this is Wendy Bauer, reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review. It's October 17th, 2016, and we will begin on the front page with the article titled, Forsyth Woman Keeping Stitches in Older Time. Subtitled, Victorian-era Fashion Never Out of Style with Rachel Crowther. This is an article by Tony Reed from Forsyth. A Stitch in Time is Rachel Crowther's stock in trade. The Forsyth woman is a walking fashion encyclopedia, her mind wrapped in the latest trends, quickening the discerning shopper's pulse back in the day when Abraham Lincoln was in the White House. Crowther, who has reached the fashionable age of 19, some 115 years after the close of the Victorian era, is a 19th century style purist who has just launched her own business, Frozen in Time Clothing Company. She offers meticulously accurate clothes, mostly for women, but some for men, targeting a clientele of costumed reenactors and presenters, or just people like herself, who believe ladies' fashion at the time of the Civil War was a winner, North or South. I sew by hand, or I use a treadle sewing machine, but I don't use an electric machine, Crowther says. Now, it could still look right if I used an electric, but everybody else does that, and I want to be different. She's busy explaining all this while getting ready to pose for some pictures outside the 19th century Trobaugh Good House in the Rock Springs Conservation Area. She is wearing a rather fetching full-length and hooped green flower print day dress, trimmed in darker green felt highlights. Black lace mitts adorn her hands, and her head is crowned by a jaunty hat with attendant veil and decorated by two plump green bows. If she had been stepping out back in the day, she would have knocked their antique socks off. This is my dream, to be making these clothes and wearing them and selling them, Crowther says. Her full repertoire ranges from elaborate ball gowns to exquisitely sewn and decorated bright red shoes, meant for the feet of Civil War-era toddlers. Prices for her clothing start around $5 and climb toward a figure she would negotiate for those seeking custom-made dresses with lots of frilly bits. And depending on complexity, she says she can turn around something like her sumptuous day dress in just a day if she clears the decks of everything else. She learned to work hard and fast growing up homeschooled, and a much younger Crowther also gained an appreciation for the fabric of time. Her mom, Latane Crowther, read to her from books on history, biography, and historical fiction, and her little girl, fascinated by vintage fashion, was sewing by the tender age of 4. She's a kinesthetic learner, busy with her hands and constantly learning with her hands, her mom said, and Rachel can do anything. She can quilt, she can sew, she can embroider, she can knit, and she can crochet. Her talented daughter has even gone one step further than that, mastering the art of spinning wool straight off the sheep's back into yarn. Mom says the pesky sensibilities of the 21st century have stopped her ever-keen offspring from acquiring her own raw material production units, however. Forsyth doesn't allow sheep, she explained. It's too bad. And the article is accompanied by several pictures. The first is Rachel Crowther, 19, who has developed the skills to make historically accurate vintage clothing, including this Civil War-era day dress replica. And the picture includes her green dress, described in the article, and her hat. She looks lovely. She also has a picture showing a Civil War-era cape in red and blue, and a skein of yarn that she apparently has spun from alpaca fur. Next, also from the front page, degree, diploma, bundled up to challenge. Subtitled, University High School allows students ability to get both at once. Aya Talmason's excitement as she describes her research on cancer-fighting drugs rivals her schoolmate Paige Fry's audible enthusiasm about her recently published science fiction novel. Fellow student Hannah Herbst recently visited President Barack Obama to explain the inexpensive generator she designed that uses plastic spoons and the hydropower of steams to charge cell phones, giving remote villagers a link to the outside world. Not bad for a bunch of public high school kids. The teens attend Florida Atlantic University High School, which education officials believe is the nation's only school where all students can simultaneously earn their high school diploma and bachelor's degree. The National Association of Secondary School Principals knows of no similar program. About 8 of each year's graduating class of 130 accomplish the dual degree feat, and nearly 100% graduate college by 19, about the time most university students are learning their town's best pizza joints. More than half enter graduate or professional school. Perhaps the best part, tuition and textbooks are free. When I was in high school, a lot of my friends would ask me, "Why would you want to accelerate? Don't you want to move away from home and do the college experience?" said Mahalia Sanan, 18, a recent FAU High grad who's about to earn her pre-pharmacy bachelor's degree. The child of a single mother, Sanan will soon start pharmacy school. She scored in the 93rd percentile on her entrance exam. "Now that they see I am about to graduate with no debt, they are envious," she added. About 700 eighth graders apply annually to FAU High, and 140 are accepted based on their grades, their score on a college entrance exam, and recommendations. Some come from as far away as Miami, a 50-mile daily commute each way. The state funds the school's $3.8 million budget, while students pay an annual $500 university activity fee. FAU assistant Dean Joel Herbst, who oversees the program for the 30,000 student university, said prospective students and parents are warned about the dedication needed to succeed at the 12-year-old high school. "Most students spend hours daily studying or doing research and still participate in sports and extracurricular activities. Despite the demands, only about 3 freshmen drop out annually," Herbst said. "After that, attrition is mostly students who move." "If your heart is not in this, you are not going to last," said Herbst, who is Hannah Herbst's father. But the 530 students aren't just the children of the well-off and well-educated. The student body is racially and economically diverse. About a third of the students are below or near the federal poverty line and receive free or discounted lunches. Many have parents who didn't finish college. Ninth graders are mostly sequestered in the FAU High building, a block of classrooms at the university's edge. One recent day, the freshmen were completing work top-level juniors and seniors do at typical high schools, like in-depth looks at ancient empires and genetic studies of fruit flies. But the most important courses, the students and administrators agree, are symposiums on managing time and acting like a mature college student. Starting in 10th grade, the teens study mostly at the university, taking classes alongside students who might be a decade older, and receive dual high school and college credits. They don't get special treatment. In fact, they are told not to stand out except for excellent coursework. Some try to hide their age. Others don't. "I won't lie about it. I am in an academic fraternity, and everyone knows I am 17. It didn't change any friendships, and I think professors actually respect you a little more because they know how hard you have worked to get here," said Ashley Amian, a high school senior and college junior majoring in political science who plans to be a lawyer. Tal Mason, a 16-year-old pre-med major, began researching cancer drugs through organic chemistry, the course that weeds out many would-be doctors. Tal Mason, a high school senior and college junior, said she visited Professor Stefan Roche's office daily, peppering him with questions until he told her, "That's not in the class. That is so high level, I don't want to confuse you anymore." The university's medical school reserves 5 seats in each incoming class for FAU high grads. One stereotype bothers students. People think they're nerds. The administration brings in speakers who emphasize that being an academic hermit will limit their futures professionally and personally, no matter how smart they are. The FAU High students participate in all university activities except intercollegiate athletics. Some join the orchestra, others appear in plays. One got elected to student government. The high school's athletic program has the usual sports except football. Don't want these prized brains getting concussed, Herbs said. And baseball and softball, not enough interest. The high school also has homecoming, prom, talent shows, and video game nights. Fries, the novelist, is also a top-flight soccer player. The 15-year-old high school sophomore and college freshman hopes to play her sport and study film and writing at Duke University after getting her Florida Atlantic degree. I feel there is balance, she said. Anthony Carnevale, director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce, notes approvingly that the FAU High students get support from faculty, have peers, and live with their parents. Whatever self-consciousness they feel is outweighed by being told they are special enough to do the work. Being selected out for positive reasons has positive effects, he said. If you tell a kid they are smart, they get smarter. Herbst said interested Chinese, Thai, and Dutch educators have visited the school, but U.S. inquiries are scant, even though the university's costs would be minimal. He thinks such schools would benefit the nation's brightest teens. I'm kind of dumbfounded that colleges throughout the country don't have a program similar to this, Herbst said. The seats in every college class are not full. The teacher is already teaching. What are 1, 2, 3, 4 more kids in that class? These kids bring significant value to the university, and the university brings a tremendous amount of value to our program and our kids. And from the local page, dredging bonds on deck. Council will consider issuing $30 million for Lake Decatur work. This is by Chris Lisvardi from Decatur. The Decatur City Council is expected to consider issuing up to $30 million in general obligation bonds as part of its financing for the dredging of Lake Decatur. The council is scheduled to meet today with the city in the third year of the dredging project, which is a way to secure the city's supply and meet future water usage needs, said Billy Tyus, assistant city manager. The approximately $91 million project is about halfway completed, he said. Tyus said the financing is going as anticipated, with the city raising funds to finance $73 million of the work, if the council approves the measure. It's in line with what was projected, Tyus said. It would be the city's third debt issue for the project, and Tyus said at least one more would be needed to completely pay for the dredging. Proceeds from the third debt issue, which is for a 20-year bond, are expected to fund the work from late this year through next year's dredging season and into early 2018. The fourth and final debt issue would likely occur in the first quarter 2018. The work to add to the capacity of the lake began in fall 2014. Previous debt issues were made in April 2014 for $24 million and September 2015 for $23 million. In other business, the council will consider a rezoning request for a property near West Grove Road and South U.S. Business 51. The amendment would change zoning for approximately 5 acres to a B2 commercial district, which Tyus said would make it uniform with the rest of the 23.8-acre parcel. The majority is already zoned B2 commercial, but Tyus said the rest of the property in the 2500 to 2600 blocks of South U.S. Business 51 and 900 block of West Grove Road is zoned in multiple ways for residential and neighborhood shopping. The property is located near Rotary Park and Red Tail Run Golf Course. No use for the property has been announced, although Taya said how the area will ultimately be developed doesn't factor into the rezoning decision, as uses can change. The City Plan Commission voted 5-0 earlier this month to recommend the approval of the petition. The decision to rezone much of the property to B2 commercial was made nearly 30 years ago. The B2 commercial designation would allow for a business to be built that would attract customers from more of a broader regional area rather than being intended for usage mainly from the surrounding neighborhood. In the sidebar notes, if you go, the Decatur City Council meets at 5:30 p.m. in the Council Chambers, 3rd floor, Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. And also from the local page, by Tony Reed, Herald and Review staff writer, from Decatur, Carrying a Taste of Freedom. Aided by their trusty baskets, 19th century women asserted choice. The hand-woven wicker baskets carried by our female ancestors had room for all kinds of stuff, including a stubborn streak of independence. The surprising social significance of the humble basket was emptied out Sunday afternoon in a presentation called Hand Baskets of the Home at Decatur's Rock Springs Conservation Area. Framed by the pre-Civil War era Trobaugh Good Farmhouse, historic site's intern Emily McInerney, in a full-length Victorian-era pioneer dress, said baskets were a 19th-century woman's passport to freedom, at least a little bit. She pointed to a large basket filled with produce, the kind of item a woman would have picked up at a marketplace. But just making that market trip, she argued, and exercising choice over the deployment of the home's precious resources was a taste of feminine control in a world ruled by men. Then McInerney moved on to smaller sewing basket, filled with needles and crochet and whatever was needed to make the fabric of life. She said the act of visiting with friends and neighbors for sewing parties or quilting bees also broke women free of male control to swap news with their peers. On that same theme was a third sample basket McInerney called the Visitation Basket, which would be filled with precious cargo like letters and pictures. These were the talking points women took with them on purely social visits to update neighbors on family life and share stories from far away. A photograph in 1860 was still something fairly new. They were expensive, said McInerney. If you had one, you would want to show it off. You were excited. The baskets that hauled all these crucial payloads might have been handmade by the woman or her family for that purpose, or, if you were well-to-do, could have been bought, something that became more common after the railroads reached Decatur in 1854. But McInerney explained to an attentive audience that it was the versatile basket, however you came by it, that often held the things that gave women a way to carry themselves into a wider world. So by these little acts, they were able to get control over themselves, over their families, and actually do something for themselves, she added. Audience member Monica Richards said the talk was fascinating and shed a whole new light on the history of a simple woven receptacle with a handle. Women were not very independent back then, and yet baskets helped make them independent, Richards said. You wouldn't think of that, would you? Next, Ryan Voiles, Herald and Review staff writer, writes an article titled, County Sets Tentative $72.2 Million Budget. Salary increases, new grants add to proposal, but spending fairly flat. This is from Decatur. Despite nearly $2 million in cuts across the board, contractual agreements and new grants have increased the overall tentative budget for Macon County. After its approval by the county's Finance Committee on October 5th, the tentative $72.2 million county budget will now be put on display for 1 month for public inspection and feedback before it is expected to be officially approved. The budget is up from the current year's $68.9 million spending plan. Auditor Carol Reed said this is due to additional grant funds, which total a little more than $1 million, as well as a new $200,000 line item for permits relating to the wind farm project and contractual salary bumps as reason for the overall increase. These items help inflate the bottom line, she said. In reality, the budget did not go up by much, if any. While the current budget is estimated at $1.2 million shortfall in revenue, Reed expects the difference to level out as the county does not typically spend all that it budgets. The overall tax levy is expected to increase by 2.16%, significantly less than the 10.98% increase that occurred this past year. The loan levy that is being increased is the insurance fund, which is going up by $360,000 to offset rising insurance costs. The county is expected to have roughly $5.77 million in reserve money in its general fund by December 1st, slightly up from the $5.4 million on hand at this time last year. As $2.7 million is reserved for expenses such as insurance, the leftover $2.4 million is enough to fund the county for a little more than 2 months. This would be the minimum recommendation of funding a municipality is suggested to have from the Government Finance Officers Association. The budget does not include any revenue increase that would come if voters approved a sales tax increase to help pay for law enforcement. The ballot referendum, which would add an additional 25 cents on the current 25 cents collected for every $100, is expected to bring in an additional $2.5 million. If not passed, the sheriff's office will lay off 4 employees and eliminate 8 unfilled staff positions. Depending on the referendum's fate on November 8th, the county's finance committee may meet November 9th to make necessary changes to the budget. The tentative budget will be voted on during the board's November 10th meeting. And from the opinion page, Tom Purcell writes, "Survey proves many young Americans don't have a clue about civics history." What do you mean Judge Judy is not a U.S. Supreme Court justice? Ah, yes, you speak of a recent survey by the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, A Crisis in Civic Education. ACTA found that a high percentage of college graduates are ignorant of the basic principles of our republic. I'm not ignorant. Try me. What's the process for amending the U.S. Constitution, and how is an amendment ratified? That's easy. The president amends the Constitution with a red pen and ratifies his changes by telling government bureaucrats to write new rules and regulations. At least that's how President Obama seems to do it. Sorry, but the answer is in Article 5 of our Constitution. Amendments may be proposed by the Congress when two-thirds of both the House and the Senate deem it necessary, or by a convention of states called for by two-thirds of the state legislatures. I knew that. I was just checking to see if you did. What about ratification? Well, to become a part of the U.S. Constitution, the amendment must be ratified by either the legislatures of three-fourths of our states, with each having equal voting weight, or by ratifying conventions in three-fourths of our states. The Congress decides which of the two ratification processes to follow. Whatever. With everybody shouting at each other these days, there's no way we'll ever get two-thirds of our politicians to agree on anything. The rancor in our politics is concerning, but what is more concerning is how little college-educated Americans know about their government. Fewer than half of the college graduates knew that presidential impeachments are tried before the Senate. The Senate? You mean Judge Judy doesn't oversee impeachments either? Another worrisome finding of the survey was that almost 40% of college graduates did not know in our system of government only the Congress has the power to declare war. You can't fault me for not knowing that one, when our last three or four presidents didn't seem to know it either. Here's a fact that confused more than half of the college graduates surveyed. How long are the terms of our members of Congress? Let me take a stab at answering that one. In the House, the terms run until our representatives qualify for excessive retirement packages, and terms in the Senate run until a senator gets caught in the inappropriate relationship with one of his young staffers? Unfortunately, you are not entirely incorrect. However, it is regrettable that so many college graduates do not know that House members serve 2-year terms and Senate members serve 6-year terms. Well, maybe this is all just a fluke. Maybe the college graduates who took this year's survey were having a bad day. If only that were the case. ACTA says that in its 2014 survey, 1/3 of college graduates were unaware that President Franklin Roosevelt spearheaded the New Deal. And in a survey last year, more than 1/3 of college graduates couldn't place the American Civil War within the correct 20-year time frame. You worry too much. What's the big deal if people are too busy to keep up with a bunch of random civics stuff? Because, as the ACTA survey concludes, our founders built a system of self-government that demands fully engaged and well-informed citizens. Poorly informed citizens are more easily manipulated by charlatan politicians who, if not kept in check, will eventually be the ruin of the system of government. Maybe Judge Judy can keep them in check. I hope she runs for Supreme Court in the next election. Oh, brother. And finally, from the A3 briefs, the local page briefs, from Decatur, Retail Roundtable. The Greater Decatur Chamber of Commerce is hosting a retail roundtable discussion about obstacles facing retail small businesses. The meeting will be from 7 to 9 a.m. Wednesday, October 19th, in the Decatur Area Arts Council, 3rd floor, all-purpose room, 125 North Water Street. Local owners and managers of area businesses will share information about challenges, opportunities, trends, and resources. For more information, call Mark Sturgill at 217-422-2200. Also from Decatur, Fall Color Hike. The Macon County Conservation District will hold its Fall Color Hike and Craft event for all ages at Rock Springs Conservation Area at 2 p.m. on Sunday, October 23rd. Participants will explore the fall colors on the trails at Rock Springs Conservation Area with a naturalist, then make a craft to take home that mimics the fall colors. This program is free and open to all ages. Register online by Friday, October 21st at MaconCountyConservation.org. And finally, also from Decatur, roadwork. Duroc Road between Kenny and Strawn Roads in Macon County will be closed today for rock paving. The road will be closed 1 mile at a time to through traffic. This should not impede bus pickups or drop-offs. And this has been Wendy Bauer with the first half of our reading today, October 17th, 2016, from the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll take a short break, and I will return with the second half. Stay tuned.